Good evening, everybody. Well, we are in the book of Ruth. Would you open there with me? The book of Ruth. If all you watched was the news, what would you think of our society? Kind of bizarre, huh? If there is anybody in outer space and they watch our TV, you got to wonder what they think about us. And sometimes it's downright depressing. In fact, a lot of times it is. And I'm not even talking about the sitcoms. I'm talking about the television shows that actually purport to tell the truth. The news shows and the news magazines and so on. But the problem with it is that you only get the high points and you only get what they consider to be something bizarre, something unusual, something that would come out, you know, and give you something you want to look at, which unfortunately tends to be the bad. It tends to be the bad news. If all you knew of our culture was these particular high or low points, however you want to describe them, you might get the wrong idea about whether or not it's a good idea to live right now. But you know what? If God puts you here, He's got a good idea about it. Here's the situation. When we look at just particular points, just particular slices of humanity and particular slices of time, we don't get a full view, and we certainly don't see the things that the Lord is doing behind the scenes. When you look into the time of the judges, which is when the book of Ruth, when this story took place, the news was very bad, and overall, the culture was in the Dark Ages of Israel, that period between Joshua and Samuel. It was anarchy to a great extent. But that doesn't mean that God was not at work redemptively, and this we must remember. Because the Lord does His work not in the headlines, but behind the scenes. He does His work quietly, and He continues to do it. It will shock us when we get to heaven to see just how successful He has been at times when we thought they were the worst possible time to live or the worst possible things on earth and so on. C.S. Lewis made a comment concerning these things in an essay he did during the Second World War. And he said, "We think that war is a very bad thing, and indeed it is, but spiritually speaking," and I'm paraphrasing Lewis, but he said, "spiritually speaking, chances are excellent. More people will come to the Lord during a war because they know," and he's talking about the soldiers, "because they know they might die." And it's a dark time, but that doesn't mean God is not doing something redemptive and perhaps something massively redemptive. And I got to thinking about that. You know, we look at the death statistics during World War II, but we have no idea the redemption statistics during World War II on both sides of the war. We have no idea how many souls were brought into heaven because people decided to take life seriously because it was such a dark time. Whereas had it been a lighter time, had there been, you know, peace and tranquility, people have a way of just cruising through their lives and getting to a point where they won't deal with God at all. They just get too hardened in their happiness. I can't believe I said that, isn't it? Can you be hardened in your happiness and become immune to the realities of God? And then lose your soul because you've gained the world? The Lord in His wisdom works in the darkness. He brings His light into places where sometimes you don't see it until you walk through a door on a dark night. And there was a fire burning, a major one, a serious one right there. You walk through the door in a dark night and you see a flame and you see light. You walk into a Christian home in a fallen culture and you suddenly say, "Wow, there's something different here." Now you see, that has a huge effect. It's not, you know, Dan Rather's not going to talk about it. It's not going to be on the news, but God is at work. The book of Ruth is a reminder of that because of the fact that it did take place during the judges, during the time of the judges. And because of the fact that it is a particularly bright spot. Everybody in this book, as I mentioned last week in opening, everybody in this book is a person of integrity. It's so awesome. Except one guy, and he's not even as bad as some of the best guys in the rest of the book of Judges. We'll see who this guy is in a minute. But even the worst guy in this story is really not that bad a guy. And the stars, Naomi and Ruth and Boaz, men and women who serve the Lord in this terrible time, they shine like beacons in the night when you really compare them to their to the backdrop of their lives. That's why Ruth is such a favorite story. It might interest you to know that it's not essentially a love story. Although we see it that way, we talk about it being a love story. There is some romance in it. We'll see tonight. There's a little bit of romance in it. But you know, really the bottom line of the book of Ruth is that these people were faithful to God. The term hesed, which means covenant faithfulness that God has for his people and that he requires of them to have for him. That is the key concept in here. Naomi had it. Ruth got it from Naomi. When they got back to Israel after being in Moab, they met a man who had this too, Boaz, a man of integrity, a man who had chesed. He had faithfulness to God. The key to the book is not the romance. The key to the book is the faithfulness of God and to God by all the people involved. And by the way, the key to our lives is not romance. I know that's depressing, but if you've been raised on romance novels and romantic comedies, you know, to find out that the key to life isn't romance, it's really faithfulness to God, and that romance is just a kind of a sidelight that's nice, but it's not really worth centering your life on. This goes very much against what our society says, very much against what our culture says. But I promise you it's true. I promise you it's true. Romance is a good thing within the legitimate bounds in which God gives it. But it is not the end all of life. Walking with God is. That's the reality. So as we look into this, and we're going to see tonight some of the fun in Naomi's little plan, and you guys know the story. As we go through it, you'll see again. Bear in mind that the real issue here is that these people decided to walk with God. And after having decided to walk with God, then the Lord supplied them with these other things. And bear in mind that if you go for the other things without deciding to walk for God, you'll lose the whole thing. You go for the romance and you say, God will bless me later, forget it. Go for God. Let him bring the romance along as needed. Or as he sees fit. Now, what has happened so far during this time? If you're with us this evening and you weren't with us last week, we're going to pick up in chapter 3, finish the book, the story, chapters 3 and 4. But in chapters 1 and 2, it's pretty sad, really. At least chapter 1 is quite sad. Naomi and her husband and their two sons moved to Moab because life was really hard in Israel because of a drought. When they got to Moab, Naomi's husband died, then her two sons died, and in the meantime, her sons had married Moabite women. After the men were all dead, and these women were bereft of their husbands, and there was no social security, there was no way for them to, and they were, well, Naomi especially, was a foreigner in Moab. It was a very, very dire circumstance, and Naomi said, I'm going back to Israel. I am going back to where Yahweh is king. Now, this is during the judges, remember? So he wasn't really king in the way he should have been, but she knew that back in Bethlehem, which was where she was from, there were people who worshiped God. She said, I'm going back there. And she did, and one of her daughters-in-law, though they both loved her greatly and neither wanted to leave her, one of them did stay behind, and Naomi said, do this, stay behind, remarry, you know, have a family. I can't help you anymore. One of them stayed behind, Orpah, and then Ruth, the other one, said, no, I want to be like you. I want to walk with God. Wherever you go, that's where I want to go. Your people are going to be my people. Your God is going to be my God. And whatever fate you suffer, that's the fate I'm going to suffer too. That's it. I'm going with you. She converted to faith in Yahweh, largely because of Naomi's witness. And she even uses the name Yahweh. Ruth, this Moabitess. Now, we think of Ruth as Jewish. Everybody does. Everybody, because her name's in the Bible, for heaven's sake. We name our kids Ruth, our girls. There's Ruths out there. No Orpahs. Very few Orpahs, I've noticed that. But Ruths are out there. And we always think of her as being Jewish. She wasn't. She was a Moabitess. But she converted to Judaism by the witness of Naomi, her mother-in-law. And so these two came back to Bethlehem, and at the end of chapter 1, it's a very kind of a sad thing because Naomi does not believe that God intends to bless her. She says, I went out full and I've come back empty. She says, don't call me Naomi, which means pleasant. She says, call me Mara, which means bitter. I had a friend who was named Mara. back when I was in early in ministry, in youth ministry, one of the girls in the youth group that I led, her name was Mara. And at the time, I didn't know that that was the Hebrew word for bitter, but it's a beautiful name, actually. But she says, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, because I feel bitter inside, and I feel like the Lord doesn't love me, and I feel like even though, and remember from last week, even though I don't believe he intends to bless me, I know there's no place else to go except to him, and so I'm going to go to him. And that is a deed of amazing faith. When you don't cut your losses and you don't say, I'm going to serve somebody else, I'm still going to serve God, even if I think he's mad at me, there's no other real God. Where else am I going to go? And that's an amazing, we could talk about that. That's an amazing decision that Naomi made. She gets back, she feels like bitter because she thinks God doesn't like her and doesn't intend to bless her because everything's gone south on her. Her life has gone away. And she comes back with Ruth, who is a foreigner now, and maybe looking forward to a situation in which she will not be respected at all, and she will be looked down upon as a Moabitess there in Bethlehem. And they come back into poverty, and at the end of chapter 1, you wonder what's going to happen. Well, in chapter 2, we found that Naomi said to Ruth, we have this program happening here in Israel. It's called gleaning. Because in Leviticus it said that everybody who reaps a harvest has to leave something behind, and you can't reap your harvest more than once. You can't go back and get the leftovers. You have to leave it for the poor. And so there was an active gleaning project going on there all the time. And so Naomi said, Ruth, you're young, you're strong, go out there and glean. Well, now it just so happened that when Ruth went out to glean with the rest of the gleaners, and this is essentially a low status, very low status. In fact, she refers to herself as a shifra, which is a woman who is at the very lowest echelons of society, not morally, but economically, at the lowest echelons of society. And that's the way she refers to herself when she's asked who she is, a shifra. That's a slave girl. And so they're very, she's out there with the rest of the slave girls. But the man who owns the field happens to be a guy named Boaz, and he's a man of integrity. He's a man of wealth. He's in his middle years. He is not a kid. We're going to find that out for sure, but I'll tell you up front, he's not. He's not one of the young bucks. He's got some gray in his beard and in his hair. That always makes me feel good about Boaz. And he's a man of amazing substance. He's called a Gibor Hael, which is a person who is it's usually rendered a mighty man of valor or something like that, which sounds kind of too religious. What it means is a guy with real gravitas. That means real weight, real serious person in the society, and a very high regard, very highly respected, and for all the right reasons. That's the kind of guy this is. And he's also very wealthy, which doesn't hurt. That's nice. He's got property. He's got servants. She ends up on his field, and it just so happens that she's related to him. Now, they don't know this at first, but he treats her very, very well. He finds out that she has treated her mother-in-law so well. He doesn't know who she is at first. Doesn't know who she, he asks one of his workers, who's the new girl gleaning? And they said, well, that's Ruth. And, you know, she's the daughter-in-law of Naomi who got back into town. It wasn't that big a town, and they knew who this was. And he said, aha. And so he made sure, he told his workers, he said, you leave stuff behind for her, purposely. And he made sure she got to come and have lunch with the workers, not with the gleaners, not with the slaves, but with the workers. She's kind of surprised by this. She says, why are you treating me so nice? And he says, because of your reputation. Because I have heard how you treated your mother-in-law. That's a good thing to remember. I have heard how you treated your mother-in-law. But you see, the character that she had shown, and he knew, if you remember, he knew she had converted to Yahweh. And he said, listen, you have come, now listen to this, you've come under the wing of Yahweh. He says this to her. You've come under the wing of Yahweh. So I want you to know that that's worth doing, and you are a person of character and a person of faith, and that's why I'm treating you this well. And he gives her a bunch of extra grain, basically. Lets her pick up a ton of extra grain. Not a ton, but you know, a lot of extra grain. And she goes home. She even takes her lunch, which she didn't finish, home to her mother-in-law, and they share that. And the mother-in-law goes, my goodness, where did you work today? She says, all this grain and everything. And she says, where did you work? Because this is not normal. Somebody, in fact, she says, Naomi says to her when she got home that night, somebody's been watching out for you. Where did you glean today? And she says, oh, well, this guy was so nice and yada, yada. Well, what was his name? His name was Boaz. And a smile must have crept across Naomi's face. Like, uh-huh. And Naomi said something interesting. She said, the Lord has not forgotten us. Because this man is a relative. Now, Naomi begins at that moment to hatch a bit of a plan. Because there was a law in those days about the person called, well, we see it in English, the kinsman redeemer, the Hebrew ga'al or go'el, depending on the form of the term, meant a person who watched out for the whole clan, the whole family. And this was a person designated as a near kinsman to take care of those in the family who couldn't take care of themselves, whether they got themselves into slavery and had to be bought out, or they lost family land and it had to be bought back, or whatever. This was a person of real substance, the go'el, the kinsman redeemer. And she said, this is one of these kind of guys. This is a guy who could legally help you and me a great deal. And it's obvious, says Naomi in her mind, it's obvious he likes you and he's watching after you. Now, I want you to notice he did not hit on her. That's not the purpose. There's never a hint of that, okay? He simply says, I take some responsibility because I have some substance. You've come under God's wing, and I'm going to take you to a certain extent under my wing and make sure that you're well cared for. Because to a certain extent, says this substantial person to himself, I represent the Lord in your life. See? A substantial person who helps other people and who walks with God represents the Lord to a certain extent in other people's lives. And by the way, needs to be careful about that fact. Truly. So Boaz is an amazing man. I mean, he really is. We'll see more about that this evening. He's a man of tremendous integrity, spiritual integrity. And Naomi realizes it, and she says, well, I'll tell you what, Ruth, you just keep working for this guy. And that's what he said too. You come back here the whole time. So they did. For, well, 7 to 9 weeks, for the next 7 to 9 weeks every day, when she went to work in Boaz's fields, and she came back with plenty to eat. And she was well cared for the whole time. Now, Naomi's watching this. And by the time it gets to the end of the harvest period, which is 7 to 9 weeks from April, so you're talking May, June, something like that. They're finishing the harvest. And Naomi thinks to herself, you know, Boaz is just being a really nice guy to Ruth. I wonder why. And she's thinking to herself, you know, Ruth is marriageable, but Boaz is quite a bit older than she is. And he might not be thinking to himself that Ruth would be interested in him. And so Naomi comes up with a little plan to find out if such a thing is possible. Takes a little initiative. Chapter 3, verse 1, Naomi, Ruth's mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, shall I not seek security for you? The word means rest. But the idea is, in that culture, I think you need to have a husband. that's the idea. And I could use a son-in-law. So I'm looking for some security for you, that it may be well with you. Verse 2, now, is not Boaz our kinsman, with whose maids you were? This is the end of the harvest now. So now they're winnowing, and there's no more gleaning at this point, at least not for barley. So she says, I have an idea. You wash yourself, take a bath, anoint yourself, implied anointing with perfume or with oil. Put on your best clothes. It really doesn't say best clothes in Hebrew. And it's interesting because it's translated that way. In the NIV and the NAS, it says best clothes. But that gives the impression that she dressed up. That's not what the Hebrew word means. The Hebrew word means simply the outer cloak, the normal clothing that a person would wear. And it's the same word that's used for general clothing that even a man would wear. I mean, it's just an outer cloak. But it does mean freshen yourself up. Make yourself presentable. Go down to the threshing floor. Now, this was not something that the women did, at least not women who were of good reputation. They didn't go down to the threshing floor during the threshing season because the guys would party a bit, and they would kind of be a little too happy at times, and it was not really a place where girls ought to be showing up. She says, now you go down there. Now, it's interesting because Naomi says this, and I want you to get a feel for the confidence that she has developed in the character of Boaz. Because some of you already know what she's suggesting here. She must have trusted Boaz a lot. Naomi must have. Boaz must have been one trustworthy guy that Naomi should suggest that Ruth go down to the threshing floor during the threshing and do what she suggests. You make yourself known to them. Don't make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Wait until evening. All the work's done. The sun's gone down. It's warm, by the way. It's quite warm in in the hills, it's a little cool. But after they've threshed this particular time of year, they've threshed the barley, it's pleasant. Let's put it that way. Pleasant evenings. And you wait until he's really pleased. After he's had something to eat and a little bit to drink, and no indicator that he was drunk or anything like that, but that he was satisfied. You don't let on that you're there. You hide out. But after he beds down for the night, it shall be when he lies down, you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. There's some real trust there on the part of Naomi. She's trusting that Boaz is not going to think to himself, a Moabite. Nobody would care if I took advantage of a Moabite. But Naomi knows that Boaz knows that someone does care. And it may not be any of his workers, and it may not be any of his cronies, but Boaz cares what God thinks. But what this is going to do is it's going to force Boaz's hand. It's going to make him make a decision about whether or not he wants Ruth. People imply, and if you've read on this, I will mention it. People imply from this that maybe there was some sexual overtones as she was offering herself. In a way, she is, but not in the way, not in a crass way, not in the way that we would think of. The Greek terms here, the three Greek terms that are used, and they all are ambiguous. They can refer to sexuality. I won't bother going into all of it, but it is true. It can be taken that way. But when you see what his response is, and then you see what her response is, you realize that that's really not what's going to happen here, and that that's not what she's intending. She's not going, Naomi is not saying, Ruth, go down there and offer yourself to this guy in a one-night stand. That's not what she's saying. What she's saying is, you go down there and you offer yourself to this man in marriage, and you will see what happens in this. There was no legitimate way for a woman to say to a man, do you want to get married? There was no legitimate way for that. I mean, even when I was a kid, that was not generally done. Generally, girls had to wait for the guy to decide whether or not he wanted to even take him out, let alone marry him. Things have changed a bit since those days. I see guys running down the street, three or four girls chasing them. I don't know. I don't know how this works. They didn't do that when I was a kid, you know. Not that I would have minded, but. So anyway, the situation was, there was no way for, what Naomi is saying is, this is a way for you to propose marriage to this man by offering yourself to him, and we'll see what he says. But it was secret. If he turned her down, no one else would know. So it was kind of a good little plan. Verse 5. Okay, says Ruth. I'll do it. Incidentally, do you do what older people advise? You who are younger and might get advice from older people who say, you know, this is something you might think about doing that would benefit your life, even in practical wisdom. Do you ever take advice from older people? It's the way it was supposed to be, you know. Now, not all older people. Some older people are really dumb. But I'm not kidding you. Does anybody disagree with me? All right. I'm not saying take everybody's advice. But there are significant people that you know are mature that you would say to yourself, well, if they said that this was a good idea, maybe this is a good idea. Take it seriously. Well, Ruth is a person who says, okay, she trusts Naomi implicitly. Because it's quite a risky little move here. Verse 6, so she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. And Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry. And he went to lie down at the end of a heap of grain. They piled the grain up, and he just went over, and he thought, I'm just going to stretch out right here. And he pulled out his big tarp or blanket or whatever, and he went to sleep, probably pretty quick. Long day, sun goes down, he's tired, he's had something to eat, he goes to sleep. She creeps up next to him, dee, 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 right? And she lifts up the edge of the, doesn't have to be a huge sleeping bag, it's not that cold, right? And she crawls underneath there, down by where his feet are. And she lay down. And I don't think she slept. I doubt that she slept. Verse 8. And it happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled, and he bent forward. The word means he twisted around. It doesn't mean that he was lying straight, his feet were like this, and she was like at the bottom of his feet. It just meant she was under the covers there with him. And he found this out in the middle of the night. Oh, the dreams of young men. You know, I mean, you got to, this guy's thinking to himself, oh, is that a woman? Praise the Lord. Think it through, guys. You guys are laughing like you never thought of that. But he doesn't respond like some lech, right? Oh, who are you? I'm Ruth, your maid. Interestingly, she uses a different Hebrew word here, ama, for who she is. A different word from Shifra, which she used originally when he said, who are you? Shifra is a person that could not possibly be married to a nobleman, a person of such low rank. And that's the way she had described herself before. Now when he says, who are you? She specifically does not use that term of herself. Now she uses the term ama, which is a term for maid, but it would be a person, an ama would be a person that could be married to a nobleman. So there's some important things going on, you know, kind of behind the scenes that she knows. She describes herself now not as a slave girl, but as a maid, one of his maids. I'm Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a goel, a close relative. Now, this is where this is extremely bold and confident of her to do. This is outrageously forthright of Ruth to do. You know, up to this time, you see Ruth kind of like mincing around, right? She's like, she's gleaning and she's so grateful for anything she gets. And she's, but she's faithful. She loves God. Now, when she says this last line in this verse, it's a shock. It's a shock. Because she says, I'm Ruth, your maid, and you should stretch the corner of your garment over me. And what she meant was not, you should have sex with me, although that would have meant that he would marry her. No question about that. But he had said, you have come under the wing. And by the way, the term for skirt or garment and the term for wing are the same in Hebrew. And he had said, you've come under the wing of Yahweh, may he bless you. And she is challenging him, not in a sassy or rude or raunchy way, but she's challenging him, if you want God to bless me, marry me. That's what she's really saying to him. And it's quite bold. It's quite forthright. And she must have picked up immediately what Naomi had in mind. And so here she is. She's crawled under the covers with this guy. And he says, who are you? And she said, well, if you really want to know, I'd like to be your wife. Now that takes some serious nerve. Serious nerve. Looking into the character and the strength of character of some of the women in the scriptures, and Ruth among them, this is a great lesson. And here you have a really important guy. She's a foreigner. She's a maid. She has no real substance in her own life compared to the kind he has. She's much younger than he is. She has no right to expect anything, but yet she's bold and forthright, and she knows that he must think something of her, or he wouldn't have taken such good care of her. So she's basically saying, hey, if you want God to bless me, you can do it. You can bless me. And I'm willing to be your wife. That's what she's saying when she says, stretch the garment over me. It's a euphemism for marriage, is what it is. Now, at that moment, there might have been a moment of silence. Here's a guy, and it was maybe dark, you know. He's looking at her. He knows who she is. And he's thinking, and it's quiet. Can you imagine, girls, ladies, asking this question and thinking to yourself, you know, you got your perfume. Smell the perfume, honey. You know, I'm here. And there's this moment of silence that feels like eternity while this man is deciding your fate. Because he could say, get out of here. What do you think you're doing? Pretty gutsy move. And after a second or two, he said, may you be blessed of the Lord. And she's thinking, may you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You've shown your last kindness to be better than your first. Kindness is the Hebrew word chesed. It's his faithfulness. And he's referring back to the faithfulness she had in coming to the Lord. It's this covenant faithfulness. And the faithfulness she had to her mother-in-law. And now he's saying, this is that kind of faithfulness. Bless you, he says to her. You've shown this, your last kindness, to be better than the first by not going after the young men, whether they're poor or rich. And this lets us know that he was beyond what would have been considered the right guy for her in terms of age. And he said, you know, I'm glad you're here. This is a cool moment. Now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask. For all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. Oh, that's where the, you know, all the woman of excellence stuff comes from here. You know, the material, it's all entitled woman of excellence. Comes out of here and some other passages like it. If he was called a man of substance, this is the female version of that same phrase. So now no longer is she a shifra or a ama. Now, she is Isha Hael, like he is a Gibor Hael. He is a mighty man. She is a woman of excellence. She is a mighty woman, you might say. She is a woman to be respected. What an amazing thing to hear from this guy. I mean, he puts a blessing on her by just calling her that. And he says, furthermore, it's not just my opinion. Everybody knows that's the kind of woman you are. I'd be honored. That's an amazing thing. So, she's... probably her heart's skipping a beat or two at this point. He says, I'll do whatever you want. Yeah, I will. I will marry you. You're a woman of excellence. Verse 12. Now, it is true that I'm a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. Well, how did he know that? Did he do a little homework about the Goel and who ought to be able to maybe might get around to maybe buying her land and taking over her family inheritance and marrying her? I don't know, but he knew right off the bat. So here they are sitting on the blanket talking, and he says, well, there is another guy I happen to know that is a closer relative, and he has first dibs on you. So let me deal with this. Remain this night. He does not use the word for sleeping together. But he does tell her, just stay here until the sun arises. Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he, this other guy, will redeem you, well, good, let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. So lie down here until morning. And again, I bet you anything she did not sleep, I'll bet you he didn't sleep as they wondered what was going to happen. They passed the night until it was just before dawn and before you could recognize one another, it says. So she lay at his feet until morning and rose before one could recognize another. And she said, and he said to the guys who knew, because the guys are up early, you know, and they get up and they, the boss has a girl on the other side of the grain pile. You know, and he walks around the corner and all the guys are scuffing their feet. Well, yeah, whoa, how about those Dodgers? And he says, okay, shut up, all of you guys. Don't anybody say anything. No one knows the woman was here. You got that? Got it, boss. No problem. She was never here. We never saw her. Who? What woman? So he takes her over to where the pile of grain is, and he says, give me your cloak. And she holds it out kind of like a little sack here. And he fills it with grain, 6 measures of barley, which would weigh anywhere from 60 pounds to 90 pounds. So she's probably not some slight little tiny thing because she hauls this up the hill to mom. So she gets there to mom. No kidding. I mean, can you imagine? I wouldn't give my wife a 90-pound bale of hay to haul. Would you? I don't do a 90-pound bale of hay. So, Jesus, serious woman. It's funny, we get these pictures, don't we? Pictures. I know what Ruth looked like, you know. Twiggy. Yeah, right. So anyway, so she gets home, dumps the grain. Well, and now her mother-in-law says, how did it go? But that's how it's rendered in English. In Hebrew, it's, who are you? You guys are getting it, aren't you? Who are you? What's your new internal identity? Because they knew what she was doing. She was going down there to see if he wanted to marry her. And if he said yes, what Naomi's really asking is, honey, are you Mrs. Boaz? Is that what's going to happen here? Who are you? She asks, literally. And she told her all that the man had done for her. And she said, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me. And he said, famous and very wise words, do not go to your mother-in-law empty-handed. There's a lot of good mother-in-law wisdom here. And so Naomi says, you wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter's going to turn out, because this man will not rest until he's settled it, and he'll do it today. Naomi's a wise woman. She knows, 6 measures of grain, and he said this to her. Here's a guy who's going to finish this business ASAP. He's serious. He's hooked, says Naomi. So you just sit tight, honey. You wait for him to deal with it. It's a great moment. Naomi must have been smiling from ear to ear, because she knew that once a man of integrity decides the right thing to do, nothing stops him from doing it. He'll deal with this thing. He will deal with it. You will not have to worry. I know this guy. If once he knows the right thing to do, he needed a little nudge. But once he knew the right thing to do, he would do the right thing. That is a great thing to remember, by the way, as men. Once you know the right thing to do, you do the right thing. And all the women in your life ought to know that that's the case for who you are. And there's this huge rest that comes. Naomi is now at peace, and so is Ruth. Why? Because they can trust Boaz. That's why. They can trust him. They know he's going to do the right thing. And even if it doesn't work out that he gets to marry her, but it's obvious he wants to. Even if it doesn't work out that he gets to marry her, he's still going to make sure it's done legally and it's done right and they're going to be cared for. And that's a good thing to know. Now Boaz went up to the gate. He sat there. That's where everything was done. It's like the courthouse, the gate of the city. It's a great big place. And behold, the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by. And he said, hey, turn here, friend. And we don't know the guy's name. And the name that he uses is kind of odd that he uses for this person. He doesn't use a real name. He uses a name like so-and-so. Hey, you. Hey, buddy. You know, that kind of concept. Doesn't give his name. Sit down. Here. Come on. Over here. And so he came over and he sat down. He took 10 men of the elders of the city. He said, sit down over here. So they all came. They sat down. Well, this means they're going to do business. So whatever, you know, they're looking, you know, what do you want? And of course, they're all important guys. They all know the scene. They're all well known in the town. This is where they did business, was in the courts, in the gates, which served as the courts. So this is official now. And he says to the closest relative, Naomi, he doesn't mention Ruth. Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell a piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. They're all from the same tribe. Now notice how he puts it. So I thought to inform you, saying, buy it. You're the first one that gets it. Buy it before those who are sitting here in court here. You go ahead and buy it. Before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. If not, then tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I'm after you. And the guy said, I'll take it. And Boaz is saying, look, here's the situation. There's this inheritance. Somebody needs to buy it. And you get first dibs. If you don't want it, I get it. The guy says, oh, no, I want it. I'll take it. I'll take the land. Boaz said, oh, by the way, on the day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth, the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased. Uh-oh, because see, in Levirate law, if you took the land and the widow came with it, that meant that the children born of your union would be as though they were the previous husband's kids. They would have his name and the land would belong to them. This is not nearly such a lucrative deal as this guy originally thought. In fact, it could jeopardize his own inheritance, and it's not a really, you know, it's obvious that he was in this for the money. The widow of the deceased, in middle of verse 5, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. And this closest relative said, I can't do that. I thought I could, but just, you know, I just checked with my accountant and it's not going to work out. I cannot redeem it for myself lest I jeopardize my own inheritance. You know, it's a guy who's willing to be involved with the covenant and with obeying God, as long as there's some profit in it. But not if he's liable to lose anything. Incidentally, the same loss would have occurred to Boaz. See, Boaz isn't going to gain anything here except added responsibility for Ruth, taking care of her, raising more kids. I need kids at my age. Huh? See, here's a situation where one guy's saying, I don't want the responsibility, and the other guy's saying, I'm willing to take responsibility. So Boaz, he dropped the bomb on him there, and he kind of figured what would happen. So the guy says, no, you go ahead. And now he's saying it in front of 10 guys, so now this is very official. You go ahead, I can't redeem it, you take it. Now, this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redemption and exchange of land and confirmation of a matter. A man took off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was a manner of attestation. It was the way they did it. He takes off his sandal, hands it to him. That means we've done business. So the closest relative said to Boaz, buy it for yourself. He removed his sandal, and Boaz said to the elders, you're witnesses today. I have bought the land of Naomi. It's like he's down at the recorder's office. That's what's happening here. Very legal, very straightforward. I've bought the land of Naomi, belonged to a and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased, very official language, the deceased on his inheritance, so the name of the deceased may not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. And you are witnesses today. The people said amen to that. All that were there at the court, it says court, but it's referring to the gates. We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, of course, the matriarchs of Israel, both of whom built the house of Israel. May you achieve wealth in Ephratah, which is Bethlehem, become famous in Bethlehem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. These guys had nothing to do but say lots of flowery things through the offspring which the Lord gave you by this young woman. Well, this is all very official. And by the way, it's spiritual. These guys all honor God here in the middle of the judges. This is a whole community in Bethlehem at the time where these guys are saying amen to this. He does it legally, and the faithful community says amen to it. He could have said, I've just taken her. He could have slept with her that night and come back and afterwards said, well, this is an established fact. And it would have been considered so by those people. But he didn't. He did it legally. He did it right. He did it honorably. He wanted her to be a real wife. And he honored her tremendously by doing this. And he did not have to in that culture. He didn't have to do that. But he was a man of integrity. So Boaz took Ruth. She became his wife. He went into her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive. She gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today. And may his name become famous in Israel. May he also be to you a restorer of life, a sustainer of your old age. This little guy is going to grow up and support you, Mom. May your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. Verse 16, then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. And the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi. They named him Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Backs up a few generations. To Perez was born Hezron, to Hezron Ram, to Ram Amminadab. To Amminadab was born Nahshon, to Nahshon Salmon. Who was married to Salmon? Rahab. Rahab. Remember? And the spies, the hooker from Jericho. You know what this is? This is the genealogy for Jesus. You see it again in Matthew. This is the genealogy not just for David, but for the Messiah. And by the way, it's the only birth narrative that we have for David. And that's odd, because important people have birth narratives. This is the only one there is. This is the only one that shows in the Old Testament where David came from. Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse was born David. An awesome thing in this dark day that the Lord was doing a redemptive work, preparing the way for King David and preparing the way for the Messiah. Right here in the midst of all of this mess called the time of the judges, here's a bright spot where God is at work. It's an awesome thing. Let me mention a couple things in closing here, just to kind of tie it up and learn a little, maybe a little bit of wisdom from this. A couple of thoughts. The first is this. Maturity in the Lord is always shown by your character, not by your giftedness. Do you notice that? It is the character of these people that stands out. Character is quiet. Stress may not create character. I don't believe stress actually creates character. I think it actually reveals it. But character is what shows that you belong to God. You see it in Naomi, you see it in Boaz, and you see it in Ruth, just as clear as a bell. Never mistake giftedness for character. And never trade them. Never trade character for giftedness. Don't trade your character for promotion. Don't trade your character for anything. Because it shows that you really belong to the Lord. It shows that you're really mature. And I'll tell you where character shows up the clearest, and it's in small gatherings. Little towns. In little towns, everybody knows who the drunks are. Everybody knows who the dealers are. Everybody knows who the honorable people are. Everybody knows everybody else's business. And we say, well, that's just really bad. In a way, it is a pain. And by the way, the same is true in churches. Especially churches where you get to know people, you get involved. You kind of know who's got character and who doesn't. You kind of find out some don't, and you wonder why God might love them and what he might have overlooked the fact that they're here, perhaps. But you have to leave that in his hand. The moral we need to learn from this is, in a small gathering, over a long period of time, whether it's a family or a church or a town, your character is going to show. You cannot hide it. So it is best to make sure you've got good stuff. Because it's going to come out. If you're honest, it's going to come out. If you're a crook, it's going to come out. If you're an adulterer, it's going to come out. You can't hide it. You won't be able to. And some people really like the larger gatherings around the world because they really don't want their character known and they like the anonymity of it. And I think that's why God really has a lot of small churches. And I think it's why some people leave churches. Not always do they leave for a wrong reason. But sometimes it is that they just don't want to be known for what they do. So they have to change churches a lot. And again, don't get me wrong. Changing churches is not always a bad thing, especially if you're coming here. You know, then that's a good thing. No, not. I'm only teasing. But you know what I'm saying. Make sure you got the right kind of character. That no matter what size group you're in, when people get to know you, they know you're a person who can be trusted. Character shows maturity, and maturity in the Lord is shown more by character than by giftedness. Here's the second thing. Confidence in the Lord still leaves room for initiative. Isn't that interesting? Naomi had some real initiative. She had great confidence in God, but she did not just lay there. She did not just say, well, if the Lord wants something to happen, he's going to make it happen. When she saw there was an opportunity, she thought, you know what? I got to do something. And she made a decision, and Ruth made a decision, and then Boaz made a decision. All of them took some initiative. And it's you got to be careful as a Christian not to just lay back and say to yourself, well, I'm just sure God will do whatever's necessary. I'm going to watch TV. What you need to do is say, Lord, I know you're at work. I'm resting in what you're doing. But if you show me a direction to move in my life, I will step out and move. I will do what you want me to do. It's this great balance between the idea that you know God is at work and the idea that you know he's called you to actually do something. In Philippians 2, 12 and 13, it says, work out your salvation in fear and trembling, knowing that it is God who is at work within you, both to will and to do according to his good pleasure. Balancing that, you doing something and knowing he's at work. Keep that balance. Don't fall into quietism, which is an old heresy that says, I don't do anything, God does it all. Or activism, which is a new heresy that says, you do it all, and God stands there with a stopwatch and a clipboard. And he just, at the end, after you've done it all, he decides whether you've done enough. That's activism. In between those two extremes is the truth. You rest in God, but then when he calls you, you say, okay, Lord. Let me just offer a little advice on that. Let me give you some things, and if you take notes, jot it down. How can you do this? Well, first, commit yourself to God's purposes, not your own. If you want to find God's will and you want to know when to take initiative, then you'd be more committed to his purposes than yours. Don't say, what's your will? What do you want to do with my life, Lord? Say, what are you doing, Lord, and how can I help? It's his purposes, not ours. It's his. So we say, Lord, what are you doing? And I want to commit to you and to what you're doing. Start there. Secondly, put yourself in a place where there is covenant blessing. That's what Naomi did when she left Moab and came back to Israel. You want really to have a place, a time when God says, yeah, time to move. Then first of all, put yourself in among those who walk with God. And in the new covenant, that means be part of a church. That means be part of a church. That means gather with other Christians. Be in the covenant community. Don't cut your own deal with God. Be a lone ranger. Be among the people that are walking with God. Commit your way to him. Put yourself in a place of covenant blessing. Third, do whatever you do with excellence and honor. Whatever he gives you to do, whether it's small, gleaning, or just treating your mother-in-law good, do whatever you do with excellence and honor. You notice how that's how Ruth's reputation grew, and when the opportunity arose, it was paved the way for her. Why? Her character was seen. What she did with excellence and honor. Do everything that way. And stay in the, along the same line, stay in the legal and the moral parameters of your culture. Stay within the legal and the moral parameters. That's the excellence and the honor. Don't get out on the fringes of morality and legality. Fourth, initiate when it seems right and when you can see what to do. Initiate when it seems right and when you can see what to do. And you will know. You will. If you've done these other things, and you're walking with God, and something comes up, and a door starts to crack open, you will know. I promise you, you'll know. Initiate when it seems the right time and the right thing, and you know what to do, the next step to take. You can see it. That's what Naomi saw. She realized that was it. She didn't have Ruth go down there until after the 6 weeks or 10 weeks of working, and she realized, hey, I've got an idea. And that's how it happens over time. You'll know. If you're in the right place and your heart's right with God, you'll know. You don't have to worry because he's a great communicator. Initiate when it seems right and when you can see what to do, when you can see the next step to take. And here's the final one. Take responsible and faithful risks as God opens the doors. That's exactly what Naomi and Ruth did. Major risk, but it was time to take the risk. And there are times like that. Responsible and faithful risks. You can't live life without risk. If you're going to trust God in a fallen world, you will have times when he says, it seems like the right thing to do, and you're not just obeying somebody else's vision. You really sense it in your heart that this is God's move. Don't be afraid to take the risks when that is the case. And you will find that he is faithful. God is at work even in the darkest times. If people will say, Lord, what are you doing? How can I be a part of it? I want to serve you, whether it's owning a field, being a business owner like Boaz, or serving within that business like Ruth and Naomi. They all had the Lord first. And he works his redemption. When this whole thing was finished, the Messiah's line was being put together with these people. The Messiah's line is being put together with us. There are people who will come to Christ because of who you are. Because of the fact that you said, I want to walk with God. I want to serve God. I want my business or my work or whatever I do. And I'll take the opportunities that present themselves. And I'll initiate when it seems like the right thing. And you'll find that the Messiah's line will move through you into somebody else's life. It's an awesome thing. Yeah, we live in a dark time. But it's not darker than the Judges. And the same Lord is Lord of all. It's really good time to live. It's a good time to serve. And to be part of the program that God's in. Let's bow our heads. Father, we love you, Lord. And sometimes we get so depressed, we just get, looking around at our world, we just get bummed out. We think there's nothing good that can happen, and inertia sets in. We forget that you are at work redemptively. We thank you for every opportunity we have to represent you one-on-one, behind the scenes where nobody knows. And we pray that you'd increase those opportunities, Father. Teach us how to take initiative, how to walk with you, how to be people who bear your name well. Amen.